It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We're going to, of course, cover the security news. And as usual, there's a lot of it, including a new Windows vulnerability. Hey, only $95,000 if you got the scratch. We'll also get back into this IoT security issue. He's going to take a look at three different makes of baby monitors and show you just how insecure they can be. That's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 563, recorded Tuesday, June 7th, 2016, IoT Infancy, Part 2. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the promo code SN30. And by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Go to ring.com/securitynow and get $50 off the Ring of Security Kit with their limited time offer. It's time for Security Now, the show where we talk about the latest insecurity and privacy and protecting yourself online with this guy right here, Mr. Stephen Gibson of GRC.com. Yo, Steve.
Good to see you. So it's a California primary day.
I voted.
Yep. I did too. I'm a permanent by mail voter.
I am too. And, but you know what I do is I take the mail ballot, mark it up at home because that's easier.
Yep. Then
I
bring and then it, go down.
But
to the
I like to
place.
Get my sticker.
Yep. Fun to have the I voted sticker. I like that too.
So in fact, I told them at the polling booth first. I said, "Thank you for your service. I appreciate you doing this, and I only came here for the sticker." And they said, "All right, put your ballots in the box there, and here's your sticker."
That's cute. So we're going to continue with last week's coverage, thanks to some really, really great reporting that the security firm Rapid7 did when they analyzed the security of 10 different baby monitors. First part, last week, we talked sort of generically about sort of the fundamental problem of a non-security focused product which wants to create a turnkey appliance that is, in this case, selling to a market that, you know, they're not security people, I guarantee you. I mean, we may have some listeners who have baby monitors, but not the other way around. It's not like they're all concerned about or even conscious of the issues of security. So here's these products selling, you know, on the internet, which offer remote viewing of the activity in front of the camera. And unfortunately, as we will cover in detail at the end of this podcast, they're offering much more access than any owner could possibly believe. And this is the way the world is at this point. I'm hoping, and I'm going to summarize at the end, one of the consequences of us not fixing this quickly. So anyway, I think a really interesting podcast. We've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. I'm going to begin with, before the security news, with what I'm going to try to keep from being a rant. I called it the reality check timeout. So I just have to say something because the pressure's been building for a couple of months, and it's like, okay, but I'm going to keep it. You know, our listeners will not have to turn the volume down on, you know, on their earphones. There is a new zero-day Windows exploit on the market, and literally market, selling for $95,000. A horrifying and very clever chip-level exploit that is, you know, silicon level, which has been called by the press demonically clever. And we're going to talk about the details of how that works. Yesterday was the June update for Android with a bunch of fixes. A little bit of news on two fronts about Facebook, one that affected Mark Zuckerberg directly and one involving Facebook's Messenger program. I ran across an interesting little aside in the New York Times I want to talk about the five things that give self-driving cars the biggest problems. Many of our listeners who were really listening and paying attention when I was talking about Squirrel's authentication management all brought up the same issue. So I want to cover that. We have a little bit of miscellaneous stuff, and then we're going to get into the horrifying details of why you want to be very careful when you buy a baby monitor that offers internet connectivity.
Especially if you're monitoring more than your baby.
Yes, exactly. if you you don't want this aimed into your bedroom.
Yeah, no. You know what I'm saying here.
And I was worried about maybe the crib next to the bed, you know, so they get sort of a package deal. Oh,
Our show today brought to you by our good friends at IT Pro TV. We love IT Pro TV. I know you're going to love them too. They are really a boon for anybody who wants to get into the IT business, because you know the key to getting into the IT business is frankly having the certs that make it possible to get a job. And you know, if you've not worked in IT, you need these certs just to show an employer, yeah, I know the basics, the fundamentals. And a lot of people spend a lot of money going to technical schools or buying a lot of study manuals, getting tutoring to take these tests. This is a much better and, by the way, much more affordable way to do it. IT Pro TV. And it's so good. It's so entertaining. It's so fun that a lot of people who aren't going for the certs, who already have the job, continue to watch IT Pro TV to keep their skills up to date. And I think that's pretty high testimony to the value of IT Pro TV. I love it that you can watch Tim and Don and their trainers on your Roku, on your Apple TV, on your computer, on your tablet. You know, everywhere you are, it's just so great. That means you can leave it on in your living room. You know, you put it as sports Chromecast. Put it up through your Chromecast on your TV. So you'll absorb this stuff. They broadcast, as we do, live, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. That's Eastern time. And they have two channels. I mean, this is how much bigger they are than we are. They now do 50 hours of new content every single week. And everything that they do goes up on their course library. So that means they have thousands of hours of instructional material, up-to-date instructional material, in every area of IT. Apple, Cisco, Amazon, CompTIA, EC Council, ISC Squared, Microsoft, VMware. Even, you know, basic technical skills like Active Directory and Azure, Azure SQL, Zen Server, crypto. There's a 12-hour course on crypto all by itself. Here's one that would be a really good skill to have: digital forensic investigator. You know, our local police department called me up and said, I've been assigned to be the forensics guy at the Petaluma PD. I need to learn Wireshark. And I said, Wireshark, just start, go to itpro.tv, take the Wireshark course, and then go on. Security fundamentals, security tech skills, Python programming, network troubleshooting. You're probably going to have to learn Nmap, right? It's all here. Kali Linux, you want to be a pen tester? That is the awesomest. 14 hours on Kali Linux and all the pen test tools built in. I could go on and on. But here's the deal. You could try it right now. itpro.tv/securitynow. Use the offer code SN30. You'll get 30% off for the life of your account and 7-day free trial. itpro.tv/securitynow. Go there. That way Steve gets credit. itpro.tv/securitynow. They also sell on Amazon. I think they're the first IT trainer to offer courses on Amazon, which is pretty darn cool. That new Amazon Video Direct, I think subscriptions are probably what you want to do. But if there's just one thing you want to take, you can buy them that way too. CCNP Security, Certified Cloud Security Professional, Microsoft Servers 2016 MCSE, AWS. That great. I would love this cert. If I were starting out today, I would go get the Certified Ethical Hacker cert. I would think that'd be so great. And man, would you be employable? Hell yeah. Adam Gordon is coming back for CEH version 9 in June. They're also doing a CCNA security class. They're going to do VCP 6, that's VMware. Security Information Systems. Oh, that's the CISA. They just finished the CISA courses. That's Audit, Control, and Security of Information Systems. Brian O'Hara taught that one. They get really good instructors. Really, it's kind of neat. Look, go to itpro.tv/security now. Here's your chance to try it, to enjoy it, to get a sense of what they do. I want you to go right now to itpro.tv and try it for free. itpro.tv/security now. Let's see, are they doing it live right now? This is Studio One. See, they got the chat going, just like we do, which is cool. And let's see. Yeah. This is Windows Server 2012 he's logged into here.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know what he's doing.
For lab environment, we're okay, right?
I can they get, by the way, they have that lab environment, which is really nice. You don't have to have Windows Server or Windows clients. You can use an HTML5 browser. You could be doing this on your Chrome book. And set up a Windows Server, maintain it, run it. And if you blow it like I often do, you just restart. You're back to ground zero. They also give you the Transcender practice exams. Look, it's great. Just try it. itpro.tv/security now. And don't forget, SN30, 7 days free and 30% off the life of your account. itpro.tv/security now. On we go. Steve Gibson, Leo Laporte, and the security news.
So, okay, my reality check timeout.
Uh-oh.
During which I promise not to raise my voice.
Okay.
What I keep seeing is Windows 10 people saying that Windows 10 is more secure.
Yeah.
Which is utter nonsense. And the distinction I need to draw for, like, again, the reality check is that added security features is completely different from security. And in fact, you can argue strongly that added security features decrease the security of the system until they are proven. I will never forget Steve Ballmer prancing around on stage before the release of Windows XP, claiming that it was the most secure operating system ever. And we said at the time, you can't say that. That's not something that anyone can declare. XP had more features. In fact, it was the first Windows operating system with a firewall. Unfortunately, they'd forgot to turn it on. So it wasn't until Service Pack 2 that it was turned on. So the point is, I don't argue that Windows 10 has more security features, but that's completely separate from it being more secure. And in fact, every lesson that we are taught by feedback from reality is that new code has bugs. And the more new code you have, the more bugs you have. And it takes time to find them and remove them. And Leo, you were talking, I think it was on Saturday, you were mentioning Debian's stable track. And how there's been some controversy over some guy that wants to change the screensaver on the
JWZ.
Debian. Yeah. And they're saying, no, you know, don't mess with it. And I was just sort of smiling because it's like, yes, that is the correct philosophy if you want stability. If you want a stable system, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
That's actually a good point. That's the graybeard's attitude in Debian is if you use Debian stable, you're going to be using old software
right.
because it's proven. And we'll do patches,
But well, we're not going to be upgrading it to the latest stuff all the time.
You know, I only moved GRC servers off of Windows 2000 a couple years ago because Windows 2000 didn't understand any of the new SSL TLS protocols. So I had to. But that thing sat there and ran literally years at a time, just like a bulletproof Unix box that just sits in a closet and you forget about it because it never has a problem. I mean, that's what you want if you want stability. Now, I get it. And in fact, Paul's term, Windows enthusiast, is the perfect one. Because again, I don't have anything against Windows 10. As everybody knows, I use Windows. I love Windows. But I also understand that new is not necessarily better. And that's the other thing, is that this is not, Windows 10 is not a new operating system. That's another myth that Microsoft pushes and has always pushed because they want to get people to upgrade. Until Windows 10, it was revenue generating for them. Now they're going to arrange to generate their revenue somehow else. But how do we know it's not new? It's because when a defect is found, it affects all previous versions of Windows. Think about it. We always see that. Every problem that is found affects every previous version. Well, if it was a new operating system, there would be a disconnection between the problems. There is no disconnection between the vulnerabilities because it's all the same single piece of code. The other way you know is if you drill down a few levels in the UI, you find dialogues that haven't changed in 20 years because the code's fine. They haven't screwed it up and they've left it alone. So what we have basically is NT with about 9 layers of different sugar coating UI wrapped around it. They keep changing the way it looks. Oh, let's go 32-bit colors. Oh, let's have shadows. Now let's do 3D. Oh, we don't like that anymore. Now let's make it flat. They're changing the surface, but it is all a single old operating system. And I'm happy that it's old because new code just has problems. So the point is, we know it's the same old operating system because every problem we talk about affects all the versions all the way back until they stopped supporting them. So, you know, it's monolithic. It looks different, then it's not different. So anyway, I wanted to make a couple of those little points, and that is that security features does not mean more secure. It actually means less secure, at least initially. And it's not a new operating system. It's the same old operating system because all the problems are shared with, you know, Windows XP and 7 and as far back as it goes. And we'll be talking about a few of those today because, again, same operating system, different coding on the top. And speak of the devil, first item here of news is that it turns out that all currently supported versions of Windows suffer from a newly discovered zero-day exploit.
That's ironic. because they didn't change it in Windows 10.
Right. It's the same operating system. It just has a different UI on top. So there is a Russian forum was found offering some guy calling. I love the name of this guy, Buggy Corp, B-U-G-G-I Corp, is offering a pervasive Windows zero-day exploit for which he wants $95,000. Now, the good news is, well, good is relative, but it's at least it's a local privilege escalation. It's not a remote code
and
execution, which would be chilling. Well, yeah, and in fact, he goes to some lengths to demonstrate the veracity of his claim. So translated from the Russian, he wrote, "Exploit for local privilege escalation, abbreviated LPE, for a zero-day vulnerability in a module of Windows, win32k.sys. The vulnerability exists in the incorrect handling of window objects, which have certain properties. The vulnerability exists in all OS versions starting from Windows 2000.
Wow.
So, like I said, same piece of code, win32k.sys. We have it today, and we had it back 16 years ago. The exploit is implemented for all OS architectures, x86 and x64, starting from XP, including Windows Server versions. And up to
be fair, that's the 32-bit compatibility layer for Windows 10, right? I mean, it's not, because your Windows 10 is 64-bit. I would guess that's the 32-bit compatibility.
Correct.
There. Yeah.
Right.
So that would be in there, of course.
Well, exactly, and it's Win32k.sys. So it is the portion that they've had all along to run the 32-bit code under Windows. So they said, up to the current variants of Windows 10, the vulnerability is of write what where type, he writes, and as such allows one to write a certain value to any address in memory, which is sufficient for a full exploit. The exploit successfully escapes from application containment, meaning it breaks out of any sandboxes, and bypasses all existing protection mechanisms such as ASLR, DEP, SMEP, etc. The exploit relies solely on the kernel 32 and user 32 libraries, so again, 32-bit, the source code project of the exploit, and a demo example are written in C and assembly with Microsoft Visual C 2005, because that's what they have in Russia. The output is a lib file, which can later be linked to any other code, just to make it convenient for the malware authors. And additional output from the source code project is a demo exe file, which launches... Oh, so he has a demo exe, which launches command exe and escalates the privileges to the system account. And he goes on. So anyway, the point is that this was found by a group, by the TrustWave group. And they said that, although such an exploit cannot provide the initial infection vector like a remote code execution would, it is still a very much needed puzzle piece in the overall infection process. For instance, an LPE, a local privilege escalation exploit, paired with a client-side remote code execution could allow an attacker to escape an application that implements sandbox protection like Google Chrome, Adobe Reader, etc. So what was rare was to find this zero-day exploit offered for sale. Typically, that's not done. There's like, you know, other exploits and malware pieces and things, but not something, you know, this significant. So they wrote, finding a zero day listed in between fairly common offerings is definitely an anomaly. It goes to show that zero days are coming out of the shadows and are fast becoming a commodity for the masses. They wrote, a worrying trend indeed. So that got a lot of press coverage too, because people are like, oh no, a zero day. But it's not, again, this is not being found in the wild yet, which is normally where we encounter and talk about zero days. This instead is like pre-wild. This is who wants a zero day and then get one. Okay, so this is just chilling. Andy Greenberg, writing for Wired, covered it. And I'll just read the first two paragraphs of what he said, then talk about this in more detail. He said, security flaws in software can be tough to find. Purposefully planted ones, hidden backdoors created by spies or saboteurs, are often even stealthier. Now imagine a backdoor planted not in an application or deep in an operating system, but even deeper in the hardware of the processor that runs a computer. And now imagine that silicon backdoor is invisible not only to the computer software, but even to the chip's designer, who has no idea that it was added by the chip's manufacturer, likely in some, he writes, far-flung Chinese factory, and that it's a single component hidden among hundreds of millions or billions on the chip, he meant, and that each one of those components is less than a thousandth of the width of a human hair. In fact, researchers at the University of Michigan haven't just imagined that computer security nightmare. They've built and proved it works. In a study that won the Best Paper Award at last week's IEEE Symposium on Privacy and Security, they detailed the creation of an insidious, microscopic hardware backdoor proof of concept. And they showed that by running a series of seemingly innocuous commands on their minutely sabotaged processor, a hacker could reliably trigger a feature of the chip that gives them full access to the operating system. Most disturbingly, they write, that microscopic hardware backdoor would not be caught by practically any modern method of hardware security analysis and could be planted by a single employee of a chip factory. And I agree with everything that they wrote, having dug into this. They named it A2 because it's an analog attack. And what it uses, although they didn't call it this in electronic terminology, it's known as a charge pump. So what's tricky about this, what's so clever, and I mean, it's like this is the stuff of nightmares for anyone who's concerned about fabricating secure processors, is that we think of a computer processor as a massive array of interconnected gates, which is deterministic. And that's the key. If it is a massive array of interconnected gates, then it starts from power up in a known state, and it executes instructions, each instruction of which moves it from one known state to the next known state based on what that instruction does. That's a programmed instruction computer. What these guys did was they added, it was described in the documentation as a capacitor, probably a capacitor and a couple diodes, but I mean, that's just vanishingly small in terms of the real estate of this chip. If you've, you know, I'm sure everyone's sort of familiar having seen photomicrographs of what a processor looks like these days. And you just kind of, your eyes glaze over, dealing with this incredible complexity of what modern chips have become. So what they did, they took an open source processor design. I don't remember. It's like OS 1200, I think stands for Open Source 1200 or Open Core. Maybe it was OC 1200. But there exists now open core designs, where it's all laid out and you can have it fabbed and or run it through programmable arrays and get yourself a nice high-performance, state-of-the-art RISC processor. So they took the silicon fab for that, and they added just a couple microscopic components such that every time one of the signal lines in the chip is raised, it couples a little bit of the energy of the edge of that raising through this capacitor into an adjacent line. And the problem is that isn't enough to change the state of the coupled to line unless you do it with a sufficient frequency for a sufficient time. So it's a charge pump. It pumps charge from one line to another in a way that no static analysis of the function of the chip could ever find it, because it uses basically an analog coupled pattern of access in order to change the state of an adjacent line. And where they chose in the design essentially removed the memory management restrictions from the program that was currently running, so that any program that was running with normal OS hardware enforced containment, which is what all of our programs have now, when the kernel decides to run the thread in a process, it sets up access to memory so that the process only has a very filtered view into the actual physical memory that is available on the computer, so that the process running sort of sees it's called a map. It's through the memory mapper. It sort of sees an abstraction of the actual physical memory. What this then allows is a process running on this chip that knows about this tiny defect that was added to the design to release itself from all OS constraints, so that the mapper is shut down and it has access to all the memory on the system. It's basically a behavior-based switch that was added that would not be found by any diagnostics running on the processor. And what's horrifying is that there's really no defense against this. The only thing you could do would be to apply the highest level of security throughout the entire design process, including all the way to and through fabrication. And in their paper, they get a little defensive about like why they did this. And it's like, well, okay, yeah, we've shown the world this could be done, but mostly it's to make sure people understand this is not just theoretical. And what they proposed was that some other kind of trusted component that would also be integrated on the chip, which doesn't exist today, would be an overseer, which would independently watch to make sure that no process running on the system had obtained that kind of access. And I'm like, well, okay, that doesn't really do it. You know, here we're back to the problem of trying to anticipate all the things that something could do that wants to be nefarious. And you can't. You know, that's the classic, you know, virus, antivirus, goodware, malware problem is that, you know, they designed their little hack to change the memory mapper. So they're saying, okay, so now we need a memory mapper overseer to guard against that. But there are all kinds of other ways you could subvert a chip, maybe a little less horribly than just remove the memory mapping facility, because that does just completely drop all of the defenses of the system. But there are other things you could do that are equally troublesome. So, you know, this is not nothing but bad news, essentially. Now, you know, there has been a concern that designs of chips could have deliberate hardware backdoors installed in them. And that's a concern. This ups the ante sort of infinitely, because now it's not just the design. I mean, you could test the design after fabrication and never find that this behavior-based flaw had been inserted into the chip. So, wow. I mean, I guess I'm glad that they brought this to light, although unfortunately I don't see a practical mitigation for it. I mean, it really sort of says to a degree that maybe helps us appreciate the fact that we, much as we want to have security is not an absolute. It is a relative. That's, I don't see how that changes in the future. Wow. Yesterday, Google released the June 6th or the June Android Security Bulletin, which had a bunch of goodies in it. They offered over-the-air updates to all currently supported Nexus devices. And I flashed by me, and I think I want to say like Nexus, maybe 6, 7, and 8. I think I remember seeing like three major version numbers, maybe 5, 6, 7. I just don't know. But anyway, it's the ones that are currently receiving updates. They all got them.
Nexus 5 and let's see. I have a 6P, so I think probably the Nexus 5 and 6P and the 5S.
Okay, yeah. Good. They did release these to their partners a month ago on May 2nd. So, you know, all of the carriers got them who want to push these out to their customers. Google wrote that the most secure issue is a critical security vulnerability that could enable remote code execution on an affected device through multiple methods such as email, web browsing, and wait for it, MMS, and we know why. Because the media server module is back in the hot seat. There is a critical media server flaw which exposes Android devices to remote code execution, such that an attacker could send vulnerable devices a malicious media file that corrupts memory during the processing, the interpretation of that file. And because media server runs at the kernel level with system kernel level privileges, the resulting code would essentially be in the media server, so it can do pretty much anything it wants to. So an important update to follow up on. Then that was one of a dozen other issues in media server. There were a bunch of, I think it was 12 other elevation of privilege issues, which could be exploited by a local app. So not a remote send you a media file and you're taken over, but rather inadvertently run a local app on the device, and it could then the app could use it to gain system level privileges, which would let it break out of the app sandbox, you know, app containment. Also, there is a problem with the WebM encoder, and that is a critical remote code execution flaw. So once again, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about sort of the general problem, like why are we having problems with these media display playback things? And it's because they are interpreters by nature. You know, essentially the files are little programs. The nature of the metadata in these files makes them little programs which the code interprets. And it is very difficult to make that bulletproof. You just have to check every single parameter perfectly and not make any mistakes with overflows or signed versus unsigned, or is this a byte or a word or a double word and so forth. It's just difficult to make that perfect. And as we know, it's got to be perfect or somebody can find a mistake. So a bunch of things. And not to be forgotten, and actually for some reason Qualcomm was in the hot seat, although you know a lot of these problems were not Qualcomm's, but Qualcomm's drivers that exist in these devices, there were 5 problems in the Wi-Fi driver, 2 each in the video and sound driver, 1 in the GPU driver, and 1 in the camera driver. So there were just a bunch of things to get fixed. So, follow up on that if you're an Android user and you didn't automatically get these things over the air. I skipped a story last week just because I thought, really? The senior editor of PC World, Brad, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name, C-H-A-C-O-S?
Chakos.
Chakos, yeah, we'll say, and sorry, Brad, if that's not how you pronounce it.
Because I'm making it up, too.
he did a story which was titled, Fearing Forced Windows 10 Upgrades, Users Are Disabling Critical Updates Instead. And I thought, really? But then 2 days ago, I got email that routed itself either through Sue or Greg and found itself to me from someone who was a little desperate. I think her name was Victoria. She had a Dell Vostro, and she was concerned that it was so old that it wouldn't run Windows 10. So she had turned off Windows Update and had 117 pending updates and was writing for like, okay, how do I use Never 10 to like, make sure this that if I like, shouldn't I have these turned back on? And I said, yeah, probably a good idea to keep your Windows update, your Windows updated. And so I said, you know, run Never 10, then reboot your machine to make sure that it takes, then run it again to make sure that it still says that Windows updating is disabled, then turn on Windows Update and suck in those 117 pending updates. I said, then I'm sure it'll ask you to reboot. So then reboot and run Never 10 just once more to make sure that after all those updates, everything's still happy and Windows 10 updating is still disabled and you should be good to go. So I did want to mention that I mentioned last week the crazy rate of uptake of Never 10. I think I said we were like at 33 or 32,000 per day. We peaked over the weekend at 35,000 downloads per day. And I said that at that rate last week, we would cross 1 million. We did that by this podcast today. We did that at 10 a.m. this morning.
Yeah.
more than 1 million downloads of Never 10.
That's awesome.
So, and that's it's let's see, where are we? 5,295 at the moment. So, and it is slowing down a little bit. We're now down to about 33,000 downloads per day. So, but it did, you know, it's interesting. As Microsoft sort of turned up the heat, Never 10 took off. So as I said last week, I was glad that it had a chance to be in place so that people were aware of it, so that it could provide a solution for people who, you know, wanted the opportunity, the option to choose not to upgrade to Windows 10. The only reason this is interesting, I think, because Mark. Oh, well, I forgot to mute that little laptop. Sorry,
I like it when
that.
You leave it going.
So Mark Zuckerberg was in the news because apparently he had an easy to hack Twitter password from 2012. Because Mark has, I guess he's now over on Facebook, not surprisingly. He hadn't apparently tweeted. His last tweet in Twitter was in January of 2012. But he apparently shared his Twitter password with his LinkedIn account. And a group calling themselves Our Mine Team claimed to have used the data from that massive LinkedIn breach, which we talked about last week, the additional 117 million accounts, to find Zuckerberg's password and see if it worked anywhere else. Now, the password was DADADA.
No.
So
how do we know that?
Well, because that Yeah. Everyone knows it now. DADADA.
Oh, that's a terrible password.
Because it wasn't only 4 years ago, it wasn't very good.
Well, but he doesn't care because these were throwaway accounts.
Well, yes. The problem was he still had his LinkedIn account. He still had his Twitter account and they took it over.
He shouldn't have used the same. I mean, I presume he didn't tweet a lot. Maybe he did. I don't know.
Well, no, he hasn't used that account for 4 years because now he's Mr. Facebook. Right. And so he's not going to use Twitter.
Right.
He's going to use.
It was to, collect information about Twitter, not to use it, not to promote it.
Right.
I remember I followed him on Google Plus, which didn't get hacked. I guess he didn't use da-da-da-da.
Correct. Google Plus was not hacked.
But he never posted there,
His Pinterest account apparently was also the same password. So he was using it in several places.
Da, da, da.
Yeah, there was some information that his Instagram account also, but that turned out not to be the case. So just Twitter and Pinterest.
That's so funny. What a terrible
also
password.
Also in Facebook news, they have stated that as...
Da, 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 da. I'm sorry. I think this is where it comes from. It was a hit called the da da da.
Oh,
either that or it's a very easy thing to type on the keyboard.
To type.
Yeah.
That's live chess.
Okay, enough of that. I couldn't resist.
So Facebook Messenger, as we know, used by about 900 million people, will be getting optional opt-in end-to-end encryption. Of course, this follows Google's recent announcement of the same in Allo, their forthcoming messaging app. And as with Allo, Facebook will have this be opt-in because its use would blind Facebook to Messenger's content and prevent the user or the use of their planned machine learning features, which, is the big new idea these days and what everyone wants to roll out. And I also heard the word, I've heard you not real being happy with bots, Leo, and apparently this is it would be a problem for their bots. And of course, The Guardian in their coverage noted that last month Google faced some blowback from privacy from activists over their opt-in decision. But as I said at the time, I think this is entirely appropriate. And it'll be interesting to see once we get some numbers, what percentage of users choose which. Because I think we're going to see, remember the studies that have been shown how people will sell their passwords for a piece of candy or something. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's like, here's a piece of candy. What's your password? Oh, thanks. And then give up their password.
Yeah, why not?
Similarly, I think when if someone turns on encryption thinking, oh, good, and then sees that it broke a lot of other nonsense that they like, they'll go, oh, bad, and turn it off again, because they would rather have, you know, these messengers suggest their replies to, you know, their conversations or whatever. So it's like, okay, so I think it's fine. I like that people have an option. And as we said, if anyone really wants security, because remember, these apparently are per conversation decisions. Not, you don't just switch all of Messenger to encrypted. Presumably, you say, I want to have a secure connection with this other person, but leave all the other ones unencrypted. So as we said, if you really want security, just get a secure messaging app. You know, they exist, and that's a no-brainer. And then you know that your conversations there will be secure. And this is not security related, but I just thought it was interesting from a technology standpoint. And that's the New York Times had a story about the five things that give self-driving cars headaches. And the author, who did a lot of research and wrote around, said, fully automated cars don't drink and drive. They don't fall asleep at the wheel. They don't text. They don't talk on the phone or put on makeup while driving. With their sensors and processors, they navigate roads without any of these human failings that can result in accidents. But there is something self-driving cars do not yet deal with very well: the unexpected. The human brain is still better than any computer at making decisions in the face of sudden, unforeseen events on the road. A child running into the street, a swerving cyclist, or a fallen tree limb. Here, he writes, are five situations that, for now at least, confound self-driving cars and the engineers working on them. And I have to say, you know, as an oldster, I'm sort of bemused by this. I'm totally gobsmacked by the speed with which this has happened, because I'm just amazed that we're moving this quickly into self-driving cars. I guess I'm showing my age. It's like, how big is your hard drive? Really? I'm impressed that they do as well as they do. And the thing that brings me over a little more to the side of self-driving cars is now watching how distracted drivers must be by their smartphones. I see cars weaving on the street, you know, crossing, just wandering out of their lane across the line. And of course, the dead giveaway is when the lights turn green and the cars just sit there at the light. No one's moving because they've taken that opportunity to check in with Facebook.
My daughter got a ticket for that exact thing. It wasn't that she drove into anything. She just didn't go when the light was green because she was typing and she got a ticket.
Who?
My daughter. Abby.
No kidding. Oh, whoops.
Not recently.
Well, yeah.
A year ago. But anyway. I was glad. I was thrilled she got that ticket.
Well, and so I see it all the time. And so I'm just thinking, okay, maybe this is not such a bad idea. But anyway, so five things. First is unpredictable humans, i.e. bad drivers. And that's like a self-driving car cannot control the behavior of other drivers. And so it's just, you know, that's an issue. They do the best job they can, but it's not like, you know, that's something aside from their ability to look at the road and know where they are and use their sensors and so forth. Another problem is bad weather, aka where did the lines on the road go? And I mean, think about it. We, as with all of our human senses, you know, rain, snow, fog, it really, you know, if you're in a heavy rain, everybody is going a lot slower because it's just much more difficult to drive safely under those conditions. So, you know, how do you feel for some poor algorithm trying to, you know, make sense of those
poor
conditions
algorithm.
with all of its different sensors? Yeah, I could just, I mean, I just imagine. Also, detours and rerouted roads. And in the article, this brought up something I didn't realize, but in retrospect, it makes it so obvious. This author said that Google's bubble-shaped self-driving cars rely heavily on highly detailed three-dimensional maps, far more detailed than those in Google Maps, that communicate the location of intersections, stop signs, on-ramps, and buildings with the car's computer systems. Self-driving cars combine these pre-created maps with readings from their sensors to find their way around. And it's like, it's so obvious after you think about it. It's like, yes, what you'd want to do is you would want to create detailed, useful 3D models of what doesn't change. That is, you know, where the roads are, where the signage is, you know, all of those things that are fixed, so that the car is not encountering them for the first time just with its own onboard sensors, but rather the sensors are positioning it in real time within a pre-existing, highly detailed 3D model. That's what you want to do. The problem is, what happens when that model breaks, when things change from that model? Because the better that model is, the more the car will tend to rely on the knowledge that is essentially embedded in that model. And to the degree that that knowledge is suddenly incorrect because of something in the real world changing, that causes a problem also. So there has to be sort of a resilience to it, where it uses the model, but there's a constant check on how much it feels it, you know, this model represents what its sensors are actually showing it, and it's able then to pull back from the model when reality starts to diverge. So just, you know, really interesting from a design standpoint, decisions to make. And then the second to last is road discolorations. Is it a pothole or a shadow? And of course, we know that self-driving cars use radar, lasers, and high-definition cameras to scan the roads for obstacles. And then the images that those sensors generate are processed by high-power processors to identify pedestrians, cyclists, and other vehicles. But it turns out that potholes are tough. They lie below the road surface, not above, and a dark patch in the road could look like a pothole or be an oil spot or a puddle or even a filled-in pothole. So it turns out that's a challenge for the designers of these. And then the last one sort of took me a little bit aback because I hadn't thought about that. And that is ethics, believe it or not. Having to make tough decisions. This writer wrote, in the midst of busy traffic, a ball bounces into the road pursued by two running children. If a self-driving car's only options are to hit the children or veer right and strike a phone pole, potentially injuring or killing the car's occupants, what does it do? Should its computer give priority to the pedestrians or the passengers? And it's like, yikes. I mean, you know, it's the Kobayashi Maru is what this is.
It's a no-win scenario.
It is the no-win scenario. And wow, you know, I hadn't thought about it. But yeah, you know, humans, like as a, you know, we're driving and have to make a similar sort of decision. But imagine having to embed ethics into silicon.
You're right.
I hadn't thought about it before. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so something cool. Many people, and I'm impressed actually by how many people picked up on this and wrote. And I, in my show notes, I have two tweets from people who tweeted the question, but just at, I don't know what time zone that is, but I just received a piece of email from someone who said it really well. His subject was rekeying DOS, as he called it, or DOS as in a denial of service. He said, I read SN562 where you talked about rekeying squirrel identities if their master key is compromised. If my key is compromised, what prevents the attacker from rekeying my identity on sites, effectively locking me out of those sites? I might not know I've been compromised, and the attacker can start with popular social, bank, and email sites to guess if I have an account there and then lock me out. Without password recovery or something like that, I've had my identity stolen permanently. Just what he says, just want to hear your thoughts on this. So everybody will be glad to know we have that completely covered in a really cool way. There's another part of Squirrel, which came much later. It was the result of heated deliberations, to put it politically correctly, in the Squirrel news group about this problem. And so I went off one morning to Starbucks with my engineering pad and pencil and big eraser and thought, okay, I've got to come up with a problem, a solution for this. And most of the time was spent staring off into space, but I always, you know, I drew some circles with some arrows pointing at them, just sort of had an anchor for my thoughts. And I ended up with what I think is a true invention, because I've never seen it before or since. It is a new way, a sort of repurposing Diffie-Hellman key agreement. The idea being that two people would create a private and a public key, and they would exchange their public keys, and then by having their private key and the other person's public key, they're able to each synthesize the same result. Now, what this and that's done twice in what we have called now the identity lock protocol. And it's like, even when I had figured it out, I still didn't understand it. I mean, it's one of those things where the equations prove it works, but I don't quite know why, but it does work. I've written it. I've implemented it. We've tested it. Other people have duplicated that work. It's all documented on the site and on the Identity Lock Protocol page. But here's what it does. We call the act of creating a squirrel login on a site association. That is, you associate your squirrel identity with an account. So like you'd already have an account on Amazon or on Google or wherever, and that site allows you to log in with Squirrel. So you go there and you say, hey, I want to add my squirrel identity here so that I can use that for logging into the site. So we call that associating your identity. When that is done, at the act of associating, in addition to the squirrel public key, which we know is how the site knows you and how the site, what the site uses for verifying your signed challenge when it subsequently challenges you to prove you are who you say you are. Two additional pieces of information are given to the site to hold, which is how this identity lock works. The what happens in practice is that you can create an association, the squirrel identity association, with your client, but you cannot change it without something additional that the client never contains. So the invention of the invention part of this was the ability for the client to provide something unique that involves a large random number. Again, remember that linkability was something Squirrel had to have, so that we're giving a different, every site gets a different identity. I needed this identity lock to similarly be different for every site, so there's no linkability between sites. So when you associate your identity to a site, you give it a couple other blobs to hold on to. And if you want to change your identity, if you rekey your identity, you must, in order to do that, provide a higher level of authentication. And that's what we have with this, the so-called rescue code. The rescue code is never meant to be memorized. It is never stored in a Squirrel client. It's a deliberately long, completely random number. The user can't choose it because users choose da-da-da if you give them a choice. So this is 20 completely random digits that is created just once when you create your identity. You print it out, you fold it up, and you put it somewhere secure. This is the way we solve the password recovery problem. That is, if somehow you forget your password, that big, random, you may never need it in your entire life, but it's there, that's password recovery. But it also does a couple other things. It's the thing that you must provide when you rekey your identity. So if a bad guy completely compromised your Squirrel client and got everything it knew, that bad guy doesn't get the rescue code, because it's not put on the clipboard, it's never stored, it's never in the identity or in the client. It briefly exists and is then embedded in the identity. Actually, the identity is encrypted under a variant of that, and you may never need it, but you can use it if all else is lost to recover your identity, to recover your password, but you must provide it as part of rekeying. And there's one more little piece, and that is which the person who wrote this sort of alluded to. What if a bad guy, went somewhere and tried to rekey your identity? Well, first of all, now we know they can't. Only you can rekey your identity by using the rescue code. But the other cool thing in this design is we allow anyone without the rescue code to disable logon with Squirrel at any site without the rescue code. So in this scenario, some foreign government you believe got a hold of your identity, or a bad guy, whatever. So just as this guy was proposing in his email, someone could go to popular sites. You could, if you believe this was a problem, immediately go to a site with your Squirrel identity and disable authentication without the rescue code. And so you would go, if you were in trouble, and did not have your rescue code with you, so you were unable to rekey your identity right now, what you can do is disable authentication. And only a client carrying the rescue code is able to subsequently re-enable authentication. So we made that asymmetric. A squirrel, you using your squirrel client can disable authentication with no additional authentication, but you cannot re-enable it without the additional rescue code. So anyway, as I said last week, what has evolved is a really beautiful, complete solution. And all of the problems with the font printing and stuff that I talked about last week is resolved. It's running very nicely now, printing under Wine, and I'm making a few changes to the UI, and then it's just nailing down a bunch of stuff from my long-standing list of things I want to fix, and we're done. So we're getting close.
Yay.
Oh, let's do a break. I'm going to
take a breath. Take a deep breath.
Thank you.
Go have some coffee. Our show today brought to you by our fabulous sponsors. And, of course, we are grateful to them because without them, Steve and I would both have to work for free. And while that works and it's fun and we like what we do, it's nice to be able to buy more coffee for Steve. For me, it's nice to be able to buy more Amazon Echoes. I have a little bit of a Jones. So, we employ 25 people. This is a big operation here, editing this video, making this all work for you. Thank you so much to Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, our sponsor for this segment of Security Now. They are bringing, all our sponsors have one thing in common. They're using technology to change how we do things. In this case, the really antiquated mortgage process. If you've ever taken out a mortgage to buy a new house or refinanced your existing house, It's kind of stuck in the 19th century. You have to sign a bunch of stuff and you have to get pieces of paper and collate them and bring them into an office. And it's just a pain in the butt, but not with Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They've taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts out of applying for a mortgage. You don't have to search through old files and paperwork because you can easily do it all online. All of it. Share your bank statements, your pay stubs at the touch of a button. Get approved in minutes for a solution that's custom tailored to your exact needs. And even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do it all on your smartphone or your tablet, too. They're mobile enabled. It makes it really easy. And, if you're in the market for a new home, can I just give you a little tip from my own experience? Get pre-qualified at Rocket Mortgage because then you are a much more attractive buyer. And in this seller's market, that helps. If you want that house, I need that house. I have many times in the past been aced out by people who had, were ready to go. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Do it now. Great for refis, too. They really simplify it. And by the way, when it comes time to do the paperwork, they send you a nice box because you still have to sign stuff, to buy the house or whatever. A notary comes to your house. You never have to leave home. It's great. Equal housing lender. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. If you're looking to refinance a mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today. Quickenloans.com/securitynow. Use that URL, that way they know you heard it here. Quickenloans.com/securitynow. Go there, find out all about it. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Quickenloans.com/securitynow. Now, Steve is fully hydrated, caffeinated, adipated, and ready to go.
So I've been meaning to say for a couple of weeks, just to acknowledge what a win the little recommendation of the sequence puzzle toy game.
Oh, we
game.
Love that game, man. That is such a good game.
And in fact, it absolutely hands down, based on feedback, is the winner, the all-time winner of all of the puzzle stuff that I have recommended in the past. And what I wanted to note was that it is, I'm like in level 40-something, and there are people like way past me, but I've never used a hint, and I don't want to use a hint. Sometimes it takes me three days.
It's hard. I'm impressed.
it is hard. There are some which are just and though for me, it's that aha moment. It's like, oh, well, the one thing I wish it had is single step. I was tweeting this to somebody.
Right, debugging. You want debugging.
Yes, and yeah. They tweeted back, oh, you mean like a debugger?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, because some, you know, you start it and it just goes. And it's like, wait, I couldn't see what happened. And I've been meaning to contact the author. But anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge what this is. The reason we love it, it is programming.
It's programming, absolutely.
It is a it's a elegant visual programming environment that has every facet of programming, because you have a goal, which is to move this little puck from location A to location B, and you have a set of tools. Well, and they're like instructions.
Yeah.
They each do one thing, and you need to interconnect them, that is, have them do their one thing in sequence, and that's why it's called the sequence, in order to achieve this result. That's programming. And it's so well implemented and so charming. I'm delighted that it's available cross-platform. So I hadn't had a chance to come back around and mention it again after first talking about it. But and people have talked to me about the human resource machine, which is another, it's more of an explicit list of actions programming toy. I don't know if the human resource machine is over on Android. I know that it's on iOS. I downloaded it, but it's in the queue because I'm going to take my time. And I'm going to work my way through all of the sequence, no matter how long it takes. I'm not in a hurry. I mean, and I don't do it. I don't spend all day. I'll pick it up. And what's interesting is that I can, like, on the third day, I'll pick it up and I'll solve it. Even though I spent, you know, 15 minutes on two previous days staring at it and it didn't come to me. Then it's like, okay, it's time. And I solved it.
Wow.
And one other bit of miscellany is people will remember this really beautiful replica that an engineer named Oscar created of the PDP-8i console. You know, what's behind me blinking are PDP-8e emulators based on an Intersil chip. The 6100 that actually was a PDP-8 on a chip. What Oscar created essentially was a switches and lights peripheral for the Pi. Why can't I think of the first name? The something Pi. What's the name of that thing? The little circuit board Pi. I can't think of it. Anyway, the 2015 version we talked about, I just wanted to bring people up to date that there is a 2016 version. Raspberry, that's the first word, the Raspberry Pi. So this is this, and it's got much more lights. The PDP-8i shows you all of the various registers. Whereas the PDP, and it was an earlier version of the PDP-8, they went for reducing the cost, and that's why you can see there's a knob there that allows you to choose which one of the many registers the lights will show. Well, those are broken out on the PDP-8i, so it's cool because there's just lots of more lights to blink. Anyway, so what surprises me is that he's offering this kit for $145. But in 2016, he's exactly duplicated the rocker switches. He had some close ones on the original 2015 design. Now they're pre-painted, beautiful rocker switches that are exactly the same shape as the original PDP-8i. And this kit's $145 as a peripheral to the Raspberry Pi. So you and all the software is there and free and available. So I just wanted to bring it up again because I think it's for someone who wants to play. And this, of course, ties into programming because the PDP-8 had a 3-bit opcode. It had 8 instructions. One of them was micro-programmed. That is, there were lots of bits that did different things in the arithmetic instruction. But otherwise, there was like jump and add and store and not many. And so it's entirely practical to write little PDP-8 programs on a pencil and paper, very much like the sequence. I created a bit.ly link long ago. It's still functional, and it's bit.ly/PDP8KIT, numeral 8, PDP8KIT, PDP8KIT. And so if anyone missed that the first time or is interested in looking at what Oscar did for 2016, I wanted to make mention of it. And I'm self-conscious now about talking about the healthy sleep formula. I don't want to bore people who don't care. I should mention it is the second, next to Never 10, most popular page on GRC, about 2,600 visits per day. So all I'm going to say is that there's been some changes. Everybody who cares, please go check out the Healthy Sleep Formula page. I have updated it with a bunch of big news, major news.
Emphasize that Steve makes no money off of this. It's just a, you know, he's not selling vitamins. It kind of sounds like he is, but he's not. He's just
And in fact, people have wanted me to have links in there that would generate some revenue for me, and I've refused because I don't want there to be any appearance of impropriety or like I'm pushing this. No, this is me sharing the result of my own exploration. So,
good job. And by the way, Steve's not a physician. You should consult your physician before taking supplements of any kind.
Right.
Your mileage may vary.
Right. Josh in Bartow, Florida. I got a really nice note from him, which I really appreciated. He said, longtime listener finally uses SpinRite to recover data. So he was referring to himself in the third person in the subject line. He said, hi, Steve. I'm a longtime listener to the podcast. I appreciate the work you do each week to keep us safe and informed. 2 years ago, I purchased a copy of SpinRite. Like many other listeners, I bought a copy just to support you and everything you do for us without asking for anything in return. I've used SpinRite in maintenance mode a couple of times, but never tried to recover data. Well, until yesterday, that is. A friend of mine contacted me for help because his computer was acting weird. He had rebooted the machine, and suddenly it was asking him to insert boot media. That's never good. The BIOS didn't recognize his hard drive and Windows would not load. He did have a partial backup on an external hard drive. However, it had been a couple of years since the last time he backed everything up. He has two small children, and he was worried that he had lost a lot of precious and irreplaceable photos, along with lots of other files. I loaned him my copy of SpinRite, recommending that he run it on level 2. This evening, he sent me another message. SpinRite fixed the problem. Windows booted normally, and all of his files were intact. My friend is now hard at work backing up all of his files to his external hard drive. I told him to get Carbonite, using the Security Now offer code, of course. I also told him to buy a copy of SpinRite for himself, so he can maintain the drive. He's planning to do both. Thanks again for making such a great podcast and such a great piece of software, Josh.
Isn't
Josh,
nice.
Thanks for sharing your experience.
Hey, do you want me to do an ad now, or do you want to?
Let's do. Yep, let's do one last one, and then I'll plow into. Oh my goodness, it's
baby monitors, kids.
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Point it somewhere else.
Yeah, there will be poop.
Ooh.
Okay, so point find it somewhere. I just got that. Ladies and gentlemen, our show today brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. And we got a new deal for you. I'm excited about this. Let me recap for those of you for whom this is a new idea. The Ring Video Doorbell replaces your existing doorbell, wired or not, with a doorbell that has a camera, a speaker, and a microphone on it, which makes it really great for keeping an eye on your place. It's easy to install. It's a snap. It comes with all the tools you need, including a level, different finishes on it so it can match your door. And then no matter – and it connects to your Wi-Fi. So then wherever you are, it's kind of like a baby monitor for your front doorstep. Wherever you are, you can see who's ringing your doorbell. It has motion detection, so you can even see who's strolling by or walking up the path. You can talk to them. And this is not just in your house, although it works great in your house, but anywhere in the world on your smartphone. They have a Mac app. And I now have, and I love the name of it, the Ring of Security Kit for you. The Ring of Security Kit from the Ring Video Doorbell, folks. I want you to go to ring.com/security now. And here's what you're going to get, and we're going to give you $50 off of it. And I know a lot of you have already been talking about other Ring products. There's a lot more than just what we talk about. So that's all included in our Ring of Security Kit. You get a bundle, including, well, there's two bundles. There's the regular Ring Video Doorbell, and now we're going to include the Pro Bundle as well. You get the Video Doorbell, a stick-up cam. That's their newest thing, which is awesome. A solar panel to keep the stick-up cam going so you don't need any wiring at all. And the indoor chime. And I love the chime because that rings in the house. And I think a lot of folks, even if you have a wired doorbell, the chime that comes with it ain't the greatest. This way you can hear it throughout the house or put the chime somewhere more convenient to you, like your bedroom or your office. And we're going to get you $50 off just because you're listening. So here you go to ring.com/security now and choose your bundle or your Pro Bundle and save $50 off. Ring is amazing. We haven't talked about the stick-up cam ever. It's a weather-resistant wireless mount. You can attach it anywhere to see, hear, and speak with visitors. So, you know, you can have both. And with the solar panel, it's really awesome. You don't have to plug it in at all. It connects via a micro USB cable. And all it takes is a few hours of direct sunlight to keep your cam continuously charged. This is really cool. So put that on your front gate of your palace, right out by the moat, and then the Ring Video Doorbell on the door. Put the chime inside and save $50 on the whole thing. Ring.com/security now. We have one, of course, on our house. Love it. And I know many people have put it up now. I know people even in the chat room right now who have thwarted burglaries with a Ring Video Doorbell. So cool. And all you got to do is go to ring.com/security now.
Well, I love how they show on the, you know, on TV now, and they show somebody who's like lounging at the beach somewhere.
I know.
And some people come to her house, and I don't remember what excuse she uses, but she says, like, you know, basically, I'm here, but I can't come to the door right now.
I'm in the bath.
Yeah, and they run away. Yeah, so it's like,
she's in there.
Perfect.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm cleaning my gun. What did you want? I've got oil all over my. What could I do? Oh, I'm just doing my loads right now. I have these wonderful hollow points. You want to come in and take a look? Yeah. They go away fast.
Yeah. I'm reloading my taser.
Yeah. Oh, I was just putting batteries in the taser. What can I do for you? All right. So let's get to monitors, which actually is fundamentally similar technology, isn't it? I mean, it's just a camera and a speaker.
Well, okay. Microphone. So the problem is, and believe me, the Ring guys are light years ahead of these products, because the problem here is that, you know, you're pushing your cart through Target, and there on the J-hook is, you know, the iBaby M6. And it's like, oh, look, it's only $39.95 on sale. Let's get one. And so it's like, no one's ever heard of iBaby. someone is surprised that, you know, Apple lets them sell anything else. So it's like, oh, great. And so they, you know, on us for a Sunday project, Dad, you know, mounts this on the bookcase and plugs it in and, you know, and then goes to iBaby.com and creates an account, whatever. And it's like, oh, look, we're able to look at our baby from anywhere in the world. So the point is, this is what's happening, and there is no concept of security. And oh, of course, iBaby has right there on the label, you know, secure state-of-the-art military-grade encryption. So it's like, oh, well, fine then. It's encrypted. Must be great, right? No. Anyway, so Rapid7, in choosing baby monitors as their target, like, you know, sort of to set the groundwork for this, they said the research presented focuses on the security of retail video baby monitors for a number of reasons. Baby monitors fulfill an intensely personal use case for IoT. They are usually placed near infants and toddlers, are intended to bring peace of mind to new parents, and are marketed as safety devices. By being internet accessible, they also help connect distant family members with their newest nieces, nephews, and grandchildren, as well as allow parents to check in on their kids while away from home. They are also largely commodity devices, built from general-purpose components using chipsets, firmware, and software found in many other IoT devices. Video baby monitors make ideal candidates for security exploration. Not only are they positioned as safety and security devices, and therefore should be held to a reasonably high standard for security, but the techniques used in discovering these findings are easily transferable to plenty of other areas of interest. Other products of direct interest to commercial and industrial consumers and security researchers, like commercial security systems, home automation systems, on-premise climate control systems, and so forth, share many of the insecure design and deployment issues found in baby monitors. So Rapid7 took 10. And in their notes, one of the things that was a little chilling was that they endeavored to be responsible with security disclosure. But in some cases, there was no one to contact. They couldn't find, like, registered domains for some of these companies. There was one that was using some other proxy that didn't belong to the company, and they couldn't find the company. So despite the fact that it was, like, amazingly insecure, there was no one to tell. There was, like, no contact information even on the packaging. It was just generic and horrifically insecure. So, I mean, just, you know, shudder-worthy. So here's an example. It happens to be iBaby Labs, Inc., with their iBaby M6. The website, iBabyCloud.com, has a vulnerability by which any authenticated user to the iBabyCloud.com service, get this, is able to view the camera information of any other iBaby user, including video recordings due to direct object, what Rapid7 called a direct object reference vulnerability. The object ID parameter is 8 hex characters corresponding to the serial number of the device. This small object ID space enables, obviously, a trivial enumeration attack where an attacker can simply brute force the object IDs of all cameras. Once an attacker is able to view an account's details, then links that are available provide a file name that shows the available, as they call them, alert videos that the camera has recorded. And using a specific AWS CloudFront endpoint, which can be found via, which they found via sniffing the iOS app functionality, this URL can harvest the file name, which allows the camera's contents to be viewed. So effectively, anyone is able to view videos that were created from that camera stored on the iBaby cloud service until those videos are deleted without any further authentication. So essentially, you sign yourself up to iBaby.cloud service, and you then start simply, you know, there's a serial number, which is 8 hex digits. And so you simply change, you know, run through those, and you're then able to access the entire install base of iBaby video streams. I mean, like, that's all there is to it. There's no authentication on a per account basis required. There's another product that iBaby makes called the M3S. Now, it runs an open telnet server with fixed login credentials of admin for the user and admin for the password. Now, that's not a huge problem because it's behind it. We assume it's going to be behind the residence's NAT router. So that would mean that its IP was not public. As long as the IP and port were not publicly mapped through the router. Of course, universal plug and play does allow anything inside the network to map the device through to the public internet. But we'll come back to this because it turns out that the majority of these devices all had locally exposed telnet and or web servers that were statically enabled. And that's my problem with this, is that it would be one thing if there was a button you pressed and it brought the server up, which you needed for configuration, for example, for 15 minutes and then shut it down. And if that wasn't long enough, press the button again and you back up and you keep trying. But they don't. They saved on a button. They just have it. That server just comes up and it's running and it's there and it's admin, or it's user. I mean, and while the good news is we're behind a router, the problem is if this trend continues, if IoT devices individually assume that they're secure because they're hiding behind a NAT router, what happens is it creates a massive target-rich environment for anything that gets into the local network. That, remember that any software running on any computer also in the network has scanning access to everything on the local network. And to the degree that IoT devices just say, we're going to leave this server open because after all, it must be behind a NAT. Well, yeah, but if there's 20 different things that are all relying on that privacy, then it creates a huge opportunity tension for bad guys to arrange to get onto the LAN or apps that, you know, have a little extra functionality that wasn't documented when you download it, and to take a look around on the LAN and see what's available. And of course, they're able, unless the user has disabled universal plug and play, they're able to find things that are locally available and map them out to the public internet using universal plug and play, which typically doesn't show up in the router's UI, and that allows them to gain public access to those assets behind the NAT router. So I mean, this is not good. Philips, the electronics company, Philips Electronics NV, they've got something called the Insight B120/37. Like these others, it runs an open telnet and web services server on its camera with static, well-known to anyone who owns one, passwords. So that's one problem. But of more concern is their web service that goes along with this, in Rapid7's taking a look at it, turns out to contain multiple cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, which allows any valid account on that site, on that web service, to obtain access to the video streams of any other account. And then what's even of greater concern is that all of the camera streams are proxied through a public cloud provider called, and I can't pronounce this, YOICS. Yoicks. It should be yikes.
I think it is yikes.
Anyway, with a public host name and port. In their analysis, the ports appear to range from 32,000, which of course is a common programmer's default, to 39,000. So about a range of 7,000 ports from 32,000 up to 39,000. And those are tied to host names having a very simple pattern of proxy 1 through 14, essentially. Apparently 2 didn't show up, but 1 and then 3 through 14 dot yoicks, Y-O-I-C-S dot net. So they note, given this small and readily enumerated parameter space, that is, what, 14 or actually 13 possible host names in from ports ranging from 32,000 to 39,000, anyone could enumerate those. And so basically you just try to connect. Once found, and all you have to do is you test for HTTP 200 response to a connection, and you know you found one. That allows you access to the camera through the proxy, and then you have administrative privileges available without any authentication of any kind to the web scripts which are running on the little web server in the camera, and you can access a streaming URL to view the live video and audio stream accessible from the camera remotely. So again, anyone who knows anything about how this works basically has the entire install base of users of these cameras available to them. Then there's something known as the summer infant baby Zoom. when I was writing down Zoom, I thought, you bet, baby. Zoom right in. The infant baby Zoom Wi-Fi monitor and internet viewing system. First of all, the Rapid7 guys found an authentication bypass, which allows for the addition. Oh, boy, this one was a good one. The addition of an arbitrary account to the camera without authentication. There's a web service, MySnapCam, which supports the camera's functionality. A bad guy issues an HTTP GET request to that server at its sysyfiserve.mysnapcam.com/register. So because you're saying I want to register, then ?FN equals, and you provide your first name, ampersand LN equals, and then your last name, LN for last name, Ampere, email equals, and then your email address, ampersand. So this is a standard URL parameter tail with name value pairs separated by ampersands that we've seen for years, that we've been using for years, that you would typically have, a simple get style submission to a browser would generate. But then the user type equals 3 for whatever reason, and the user group ID, which you just make up. You just can enumerate through those. No authentication required. That creates an account for you in that user group, and then it sends you email to the email address you gave it, providing you with additional credentials, which you then use in order to log in and access the cameras belonging to that group. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So you submit this request to the server, giving it your email address. It registers you to that account, sends you email address, sends additional information to the email address you provided, requiring nothing else. So no, I mean, it's like, it's not obviously insecure, but anyone taking any time, as these guys did, to like examine the system just sees that it offers absolutely no security. There was something, another camera from Lens Laboratories. I love the name. It was called the Lens PikaView. And it's like, yep. Multiple open web servers on their products, defaulting both web and telnet, defaulting to user/user or guest/guest credentials. And this was one where Rapid7 was unable to find anybody to complain to like tell them that your camera has wide open servers. And again, several other devices out of this set of 10 all ship with statically present, always open telnet or web servers, which the concern is over time, if this becomes the trend, if this is the way IoT systems are, it creates a huge opportunity for anything that's able to get onto the LAN and scan the network, which again, the absolute first order of business has got to be separate your network. Take the time to create a Wi-Fi branch, an arm that is separate from the Wi-Fi that everything else uses, and put your IoT stuff there. If for no other reason, then in theory, nothing can infect those devices, insecure as they are, except many of them reach out to the network. And what I just read, some of the things I just read, does allow a remote person to get onto that device with admin rights. So I didn't run through the details, but these cameras, several of these cameras, are providing active access to the LAN they are on to anyone who knows about them in the world, which means if that is your LAN, they're on your LAN. So again, we've got to separate the IoT network from the network that your other machines on the network use. It's both ways protection. You don't want the IoT devices to get over into your normal computer LAN. And similarly, if something mischievous got onto your computer, you'd like it not to be able to find 20 open telnet and web servers sitting there waiting for connections. So it makes sense from both angles to separate these onto two separate networks. Hopefully, as I said, I called this IoT infancy because I think the industry as a whole is in its infancy. But this just can't be the way we allow these systems to operate. At this point, you know, people are just buying them innocently from Amazon or Target or Walmart or wherever, and plugging them in, and they work. But boy, they're just incredibly insecure.
And they're baby monitors. That's the sad whole thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so in the worst case, the Ring, as has been noted, the Ring doorbell is aiming out of your house
into your
yard.
Yeah.
I don't care if anybody sees that. But boy, I don't want it pointing into my home, crib.
Well, it's because I'm sure if there were an onslaught of smart doorbells from China, that there were commoditized doorbells. Although when Philips makes a mistake like that, that's kind of surprising.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big company. Jeez.
Yeah.
Although they may just be slapping their name on some Chinese commoditized product.
Yes.
So.
Yes. And you know, this is the lesson that we have seen over and over and over. The goal is make it work. Does it work? Ship it. And yeah. It costs nothing to print encrypted, high security, military grade. You know, ink is free, and so the fact that it says that on the label means absolutely nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, you see why you listen every week to this show. It's an education in how to do it wrong, among other things. You're doing it wrong episodes continue. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. That's where you'll find SpinRite, his bread and butter, the only thing he charges for, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. But there's lots of free stuff there, including, of course, this show, Squirrel, the sleep stuff, everything. It's all at grc.com. That's where you'll go to leave questions if you have questions for next week's episode, grc.com/feedback. The podcast has not only audio there, but also written transcriptions, so you can read along while you listen. That's something unique that Steve does, and I think it's great. You'll also find, Perfect Paper Password. I mean, it's the kind of site you go and you might peruse it for a while, but set aside some time. You can also find the show at our site, twit.tv/SN for Security Now. And we have audio and video there. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcatcher. Doesn't matter which one you use. Just get it every week because you don't want to miss it. And my blog, as I mentioned a couple of times, I'll mention it one more time, has scripts on it. Three different listeners wrote scripts for downloading every episode with a little modification, a Bash script, right. A Python script, and a PowerShell script. And that's at leolaporte.com if you want to get that. Steve, fun. Thank you. Great stuff.
Yay.
Questions next week. My pleasure.
Be back with you for Q&A next week, Leo.
And don't forget, you can tweet Steve at SGGRC, and he accepts DMs from anyone. So send your lengthy DMs to Steve. Have a great week, Steve.
Bye. Security Now.